I will tell you right now, I have too much to say. Yeah. I'm going to try to be careful here, and I see where I am time-wise. All right. For quite some time now, I've been kind of on the side of everything else, really caught up in trying to understand, and I guess that I'm sort of doing this avocationally, I don't know. It's, for me, everything seems like it all winds into one thing. But to try and understand what is happening to time. And the thing is, it's not merely for those of us who are older, and, you know, so that we're in this place now where when we look back on our lives, much more is behind us than what we anticipate, except for eternity, is in front of us. And so it's very easy to feel the quickness of time in that. But this is also happening with everyone. Lots younger folks. And so I'm trying to get a sense of that. And what role, if any, does the church play in trying to address this? And I think it's quite significant, the role the church needs to play. And so I'm going to start today with trying to lay out some of these things that we can build on them in the coming week or two. I don't think I'll do this very far into Advent, but I might for the first Sunday. So anyway, we're going to take a look at Romans 12, 1 and 2, if you don't mind. You can let the parable of the talents sit there in the back of your mind. But at the same time, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. Many of you are familiar with this. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Let's pray. Oh God, once again we ask that your word, the words of my mouth, and the meditations of all of our hearts would be pleasing and acceptable to you. For you, O Lord, are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. A couple of things to point out on these verses. The first is to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. What stands out about that to you? Yeah, most sacrifices are not living. How about the bodies part? Now, we tend to think of that as, you know, when we think about offering our bodies, that means to keep them pure, right? We think about that. But I'm not sure that's all that means, that we are to genuinely give ourselves, our bodies, to the Lord, to present them, that they are His, that is our sacrifice. And in fact, our spiritual service, there's lots of different ways to look at that, that line, which is your spiritual worship. It means your logical service. It means, to me, it's kind of like, well, that's the least you can do. it's what only makes sense, is to give God your bodies as a living sacrifice. Because what else really do you have? You can say, well, I gave him my spirit. I give him my heart. Well, those are true and good things, but how do you back it up? My whole being, my body, mind, body, spirit. It's all yours, Lord. It's all yours. I like the Eugene Peterson description for the part about do not be conformed to this world or this age. Eugene Peterson says, don't let this world squeeze you into its mold. Have you read that before in the Message? That's a man. For our age and our era, that is the don't let the world squeeze you into its world, into its mold. So, here's my opening question for you. Would you rather have $1 million or one extra hour in the day for the rest of your life? And why? Would you rather have $1 million or an extra hour for your day for the rest of your life? Any responses to that? You would take that hour and promise it toward solitude and quiet. Okay? Anyone else? An initial response.
And this is probably not the spiritual side. But if we had $1 million, Chris could go ahead and retire.
Right, I get you.
If we're doing this ministry thing and he's having to do it on top of a 40-hour job. Right.
You feel like it would buy you more time.
Yeah, in terms of what he has.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else?
I'd go with $1 million.
You take the million?
I would take $1 million because I feel like I could invest it into God's kingdom and I don't know that I would give that hour wisely.
Yeah. Well, we don't know. But you feel like you would wisely invest it, which is like the parable of the talents a bit. Yeah. Okay. Ray? Ray will take the money. All right. Because he would not. I got you. Yeah. All right. Anyone else? Will, what would you do? You got a long time ahead of you. That's a lot of extra hours. Yeah. Okay. You take the money too. All right, Dwayne. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Much of our answer, though, it still revolves around having more time, in a sense. I mean, you made that very clear, that would be the better way to maximize or get more time, it feels like. Same, Laura, for you, yeah, in a way, that it would be time that you can redeem by giving and developing. So, all right. Well, I've been studying some things and kind of doing a deep dive and spent quite a number of hours in audiobooks and other things. And one of the things I can tell you is that our current era has moved from whatever it was in the centuries from Christ up until late medieval, early Renaissance, whatever kind of time, early Enlightenment. It is from that time, 400 years ago until now, we have moved into what is often, not often among, the common, what is it, parlance? Yeah, but it's a secular era. And I've been wondering, how does the church, how does a pastor, how do just folks, any of us, trying to follow Jesus, thrive in our spiritual lives in what is now a pretty thoroughly secular era? Now, we have our little enclaves where we think that there's still sacred time that exist. And there might be a couple of counties in the Midwest where blue laws, you know, still kind of try and keep Sunday separate or sacred. But by and large, we live in a secular age. About 10 years back, I offered a sermon series called Earth Enchanted. It was actually an Advent series. Any of you remember it? No, I shouldn't ask that. That it can embarrass me. but the visual theme that we highlighted in the space there on Depot Street was that we had a good number of Christmas trees all through, and there were roses blooming from the Christmas trees. That was our thing. That trying to understand the world as an enchanted place rather than a secular, disenchanted place, trying to see that or somehow apprehend that again. The roses might have been a tip of the hat to Beauty and the Beast, but Richard and I will never confess to that. Man, I kind of miss having a space that we can adorn as we like. Okay. So those of you that were in the John Mark Comer book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, y'all did that study. You learn that to live a life that is truly like the way of Jesus, you must eliminate hurry. That hurry is not only of the devil, but hurry is the devil. Yeah. Do you know that's a Piaget statement, the psychologist Piaget, maybe Jung. Anyway. And we know that one of the great but largely unstudied ills of our time, our era, is actually named hurry sickness. It's a thing, folks. Hurry sickness. Now, I wonder, Gretchen, if in the places you've been serving, if that's a thing as well, but we could talk about that another time because it'd be a very interesting conversation. The whiplash you may experience sometimes coming back and forth between the communities that you've ministered in when compared to being back here. The symptoms of hurry sickness include, but are not limited to, are you ready? Rushing through tasks, big surprise. Feeling irritable when there's a delay. What? Interrupting or talking over people, even though you're not that kind of person. Continually cycling through your to-do list in your head. Even while you're doing something else, it's back there going. Treating everything like a race. Always feeling behind schedule. Always, even though you're not. Continuously multitasking, which they say is a myth, but well. Always having a sense of urgency. And my favorite, rarely enjoying the moment or properly celebrating an accomplishment because you're on to the next thing. At least emotionally, you're on to the next thing. Now, all of these are often accompanied by actual physical symptoms such as a low to mid-level anxiety that is constantly present that you hardly realize for all the busyness which masks in a way, that anxiety, until you're just still enough to notice it, and then it bothers you, and so you get busy to cover it up again. Now, do these things ring true to y'all? Yeah, they really do. And I don't think it matters the age, and I don't think it matters the stage, that certainly we think of folks, busy parents, with two jobs and a bunch of kids that they have to run all over the world for sports, as well as those who have moved into a retirement stage or whatever you want to call that. It's present for everybody. And this is part of the things I've learned in this. It's not, you know, it's an equal opportunity disease, this hurry sickness that we experience. And so I want to ask this question. How often is your mind genuinely present with your body? That you are where you are, and you're not somewhere else in your head. You're really there. How often? Constantly? Occasionally? Half and half? Anyone? Have you ever thought about that? That whether you're really, your mind is really present where your body is. This disembodiment is another, it's fairly common for one thing, but it's an experience that has been foisted upon us by this secular age. Not only because it's secular or divorced from sacred time, but because it's driven by imminent time. And I'll tell you about that in a moment. No wonder that so many of the books now, if you go to a self-help section or something about, you know, trying self-improvement or whatever, about 50%, this is crazy, about 50% of the books are connected with mindfulness, which is sort of the practice of trying to be where you are, trying to get your head actually present with your body. The invitation of Jesus in Matthew 11:28 has never been more appealing or simultaneously difficult. Now, here's the invitation. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Never have those words been more appealing or more difficult to try and get into and respond to. I love Eugene Peterson, again, to go to the message. His paraphrase of Jesus' words really strike home for our present age. Peterson paraphrases Jesus' words as this: are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. Wow. Does that just make you kind of go, want to turn inside out to make this happen? Yeah. How can we learn the unforced rhythms of grace when our relationship to time is broken? It's not as it was supposed to be or intended to be. What do I mean by that? That our relationship to time is broken. Well, one thing I think of is, was man made for the Sabbath, or was the Sabbath made for man? And I turn that into the question of time, which is connected with Sabbath pretty strongly. Was time made for mankind, or were we made to be the subjects or servants of time? Like I said earlier, since the 1600s and 1700s, how humans view time, especially in Western civilizations, has changed. And it's largely because of saving time with our technological advancements. Saving time, saving work, being able to do more in less time. That's the main achievement of technology. To give you an example, even about 150 years ago, there were some great questions about whether or not people should ride on trains. Because prior to the locomotive, nobody was going faster than 40 miles an hour, max. And a lot of doctors and folks who are leaders in various civic ways said, we shouldn't do this to people. Their heads may explode. They were serious, that your brain might explode if you start going that fast for regular periods of time. Yeah. Yeah. So, obviously, they didn't, but in some ways, our brains did explode. In some ways, not physically, but it started to really change things and changed our relationship with time, and in some ways began to break it. Rather than the sea we swim in, rather than time as this palace, sort of, to live your life in and move around in and be in, it became a commodity. It was not a commodity before. It really wasn't. Ben Franklin probably capsulized it best in his quote that time is money. That's Franklin, yeah. Time is money. And once we got that into our psyche, well, how do we make more money? Have more time. We're going to get that $1 million and somehow have an extra hour in the day as well. Slowing down, I don't think, is the complete answer or the solution to the issues we face. Now, I think it's part of it. But I'm not going to repudiate all the things that we have and live in and are available to us, because I don't think that just repudiating it and going and being hermits somewhere, as tempting as that might be for some of us, is the answer. But reinterpreting and then somehow looking to God to heal our relationship with time, I think is. Time is different for us than it was for our parents and grandparents. And they would say that it's different. It was different for them than it was for their parents and grandparents. But that has only really been a slow but increasing momentum, as it has moved through the last 400 years, especially the last 250. This changing experience of time, I don't know if it's good or bad in itself, but here's the deal. I think it's been exploited by the enemy. I think this transition, anytime you're off base and you're kind of in transition and things are always shifting and changing, that makes it very easy for the evil one to exploit that and have a significant impact on us. We are in an era of perpetual change and transition. It's not just the change, because everybody experiences change in their lifetimes. It's the rate of change, right? It's the rate of change. No longer did you get used to one thing, then it's already changed. Oh, no, that's yesterday. That's yesterday's thing. Maybe we can learn how to counter the harmful devices of the evil one before the Lord's return. 1 Thessalonians 5. But for now, it's easy to look around and think about the ubiquity of change and the technologies and everything else and look at our world and feel like we're hosed. you know. Be like, what can we do? Well, we just have to live with it and manage somehow, struggle along. Well, maybe. Charles Taylor, who's a Canadian philosopher and a social theorist, he died just about a decade or so ago. He was also a Christian. He offers that explanation for what I described earlier as being in a secular age. A world that is, his word, disenchanted. And that went back to the earth enchanted idea I had for Advent some years back. In a disenchanted world, and I'll get more into this probably next week, where everything is imminent with an I. Imminent with an I. Do you know what that means? Imminent. It's immediate. It's on you. It's right now. Everything is present. It also means that everything is known or knowable. Everything is controlled or controllable eventually. That the world is no longer what we now look back fondly and call enchanted. It is no longer enchanted. That is thick with mystery, thick with unknowables. A simple example would be that today, a forest is merely a repository of timber resources. That's the secular age. That's the disenchanted world. That's what a forest is. Not a foreboding place, not necessarily bad, but foreboding place full of unknowns. Why do you think so many of Grimm's fairy tales take place in, around, or near a forest? Because of that sense of, oh, anything could happen in there. But we don't think that anymore. We have controlled. We know what's in there. It might still eat us if we're near a grizzly, but we feel like we know it and can control it. In the secular age, it's tempting for the church to say that the church must no longer make our claims about sacred time. We must no longer really worry about time to meditate, time for quiet and silence and solitude. Those are just artifacts of the past. We don't really have time for them, right? Because those things take time. But instead, we're supposed to acquiesce to the cultural time of our era, to become relevant. I think the vine reached peak relevance around 2012, and I'll explain by that in just a minute. But to be relevant is to meet the felt needs of modern busy people. That's relevance. And so, you want a church. Modern busy people look for churches that are relevant, that they feel their felt needs, the ones that are the most pressing, the most immediate. Do you remember there are a few of us who may still remember the book study we did called Making Room for Life? By Randy Frazee, yeah? That's where Randy recommended, get two washers. Get two washing machines, you can get double done, it makes more time for your family and other things like that. That was just a simple example. But so that the church, to be relevant to modern busy people, had to offer fixes for their modern condition. And here's another weird thing, that in a secular age where the imminent frame, everything is right there on you, sin is no longer so much what we think of as the excesses or the debauchery, which is certainly still alive and well in humanity. But for the secular age, sin is my inability to optimize myself. Do you get that? It's where I fall short of being all I can be. And for the church, when we're constantly trying to meet that need of helping people become all they can be for the sake of the present age, that's a never-ending, deeply dissatisfying quest, I think. The church seems antiquated if it continues in its slow practices of prayer, reading the scripture, and humble service. The church's use of the slow wisdom of the past seems completely out of place in the compression of everything, everywhere, all at once that we experience right now, in the present pursuit of maximizing our identities and innovating in our identities, changing our identities to try and somehow be all we can be. Self-expression being the ultimate good. It's something that drew me over the last decade toward our present relationship identification within the Anglican Church. I couldn't have put it together quite that clearly at the time as I was being drawn that way. And of course, I'm thinking, well, if I'm being drawn that way, either I'm going to have to leave or I'm going to have to lead others that way as well. So thank you. But it's also, and I'm just going to, you'll have to forgive me, it's also what drew me toward Michael King. Anybody else catch that? When you, in the brief time that you may have had to meet him, you'll understand this more later, I think. It's what drew me toward Michael and perhaps the search team and the vestry as well, though we haven't really had a conversation about it yet. It's that he exudes a walk that does not seem controlled by the secular rhythms of this age. I mean, I know he's a dad with kids and a wife and, you know, jobs and all that, but something draws me to him that at first it put me off a tad, I will say, because it's that whole thing of slowing down enough and then you notice the anxiety, but in a different way. And then I thought, I want that. What are you doing? What you on? You know? He exudes a walk that does not seem controlled by secular rhythms. Now, I don't mean to set him up for a fall, because we don't know him well yet. I believe that the ministry of the church, for our church, but also for other churches, if they are going to continue to minister out of the Spirit and not the spirit of the age, to minister out of the leading of God and not merely relevance to people's felt needs, that we have to address the time sickness. It has to become an ongoing component, significant component of our ministry, both to our congregation as well as offering to those who don't know that there are options. For us to offer an oasis in time, a different way of telling time, which we do in some ways with our following the liturgical year, the Christian year, a more human rather than transhuman, a more sacred rather than Silicon Valley way of living in time. And then, and I think maybe only then, can the full significance of Jesus' invitation to find rest in Him be realized. And to resist conforming to this age and instead know the renewing and refreshing of our minds.